This is Catherine McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Hey, you ready? You grab that right there.
Are you ready?
Oh,
is you ready?
Ready?
You say you ready?
Oh,
whole squad ready?
Ready?
Is you ready?
Oh,
are you ready?
Ready?
Is you ready?
Whole squad ready?
We came here to see Jet. What you got?
Oh,
no, no, no,
not on my watch.
No way.
Bring what you got. I'm going to the top. You can bring what you got. I'm going to the top.
During Thanksgiving week, on a Monday, we continue. And as I mentioned before, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff was in Halifax over the weekend. And at the Halifax International Security Forum, something that Senator John McCain was big at. In fact, when you hear his remarks, he opens with a fairly humorous, not really humorous, but kind of funny the way he tells it, discussion about what it was like to work for Senator McCain, who could be a pretty difficult customer to work for and with when he chose to be that way. So you'll hear General Dunford talk about that. But one of my favorite things to do here on All Marine Radio is to let you hear smart people in long format, and so you can understand issues in a way that you may not. This particular interview that he does made headlines over the weekend because of the comments that he directs, essentially at Google, although he doesn't name Google in the in his statement. So so he made headlines over the weekend, and so I think you'll find his remarks interesting. so without further ado, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Joseph Dunford, in Halifax. The interviewer is from the BBC. She's a news presenter there. They do not call them reporters. They call them presenters. Her name is Yalda Hakim, Y-A-L-D-A space H-A-K-I-M. So I believe she covers not only the world, but specifically defense issues for the BBC. So without further ado, in long format, in his own words, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Joe Dunford.
To make a comment before we begin. And Mr. McCain, it was worth coming to Halifax just to witness that extraordinary video in the presentation. And I just was mindful as I was watching the video of another perspective that was alluded to during Senator McCain's service. But those of us that are senior leaders didn't always enjoy the same reception that Senator McCain provided to those soldiers that were coming home in Maine. And I can tell you that probably I told you all the before, some of the more difficult engagements that I've ever had have been with Senator McCain, both in private and in public. But he was doing that because he was holding those of us that are senior leaders accountable to take care of those soldiers that he was meeting in Maine. And he was very hard on us, and he expected a great deal from us. And particularly in the assignment that I had, Senator McCain, as the chairman of the Senate Armed Service Committee, felt personal responsibility to supervise the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. I think you know that, Mrs. McCain, and as do most of the members of the delegation that are here right now. And I guess I would just say, without taking much more time, as I watched the video, I just reminded I miss him, and I miss his voice. I miss his voice, and I would just speak for all of us in uniform. He made us better leaders, and it's hard for me to believe that I could feel this way personally and professionally, because there was days I didn't feel that way. but when I look back, those actually were the good old days. But I just wanted to comment because for me, that was worth coming to Halifax.
Thank you.
General Dunford, thank you. Of course, General Dunford doesn't need an introduction, but he deserves an excellent one. He was commissioned as a Marine in 1977. He was commander in Afghanistan, commandant of the Marine Corps. And since 2015, he's been the 19th chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. General Dunford, welcome to Halifax.
Thanks, Sheldon.
General, let's begin by talking about the National Defence Strategy, which for the first time since the end of the Cold War identified great power competition, not terrorism, as the biggest challenge for America. Tell us about this shift.
Sure. For those not familiar with it, the National Defense Strategy does outline great power competition. We highlight the challenges associated with China, Russia, but also Iran, North Korea, and violent extremism. We don't offer that as all-inclusive of all the challenges we face, but we do think that that provides a strategic framework within which we think about doing what is an enduring mission, and that is assuring our allies and partners, deterring potential aggression, and then responding in the event that aggression fails. And so when we look at the return of great power competition and we look at our capabilities, we reflect back on the capabilities we have today, are those that we, in large part, developed in the 1990s, early part of the century. At that time, the United States and its allies certainly could project power when and where necessary to advance our collective interests, relatively uncontested. We could operate freely across what we call all domains, sea, air, land, space, and cyberspace. And what the National Defense Strategy really calls out now, I focus on the military dimension. The military dimension of that great power competition is, in fact, the efforts that China and Russia in particular have now taken to undermine the credibility of the U.S. and its allies to meet alliance commitments, whether it be in Europe, in a Russian scenario, or whether it be in China. We don't say that necessarily competition equals conflict, but again, in the military dimension, our responsibility is to ensure that we can assure our allies and partners, we can deter potential adversaries, we can respond in the event deterrence fails, and we are doing that now in a different context than we were prior to 2014, 2013. So that really is, in my view, the big idea inside the National Defense Strategy that informs what I believe we need to do from a U.S. military and alliance perspective.
Well, this week a report by the Congressionally Appointed Commission on the NDS came out. For those who haven't read it, it's a sobering read. I urge you to read it. It's about 100 pages long, and I looked at it on the flight over. Basically, what the report says, though, is that we're losing our military edge, especially when it comes to Russia and China. Do you agree with that?
First of all, what I say internally to our leadership is today we can meet our alliance commitments against any potential adversary, particularly if you look at it in a coalition alliance perspective. We can defend the homeland, and we have a competitive advantage over any potential adversary. I believe that to be the case in 2018. But I also know that our relative competitive advantage, again, in projecting power and operate freely across all domains, has eroded over the past 10 or 15 years as we were almost singly focused for a while on dealing with violent extremism. And frankly, as I say, we didn't have much hot breath in the back of our neck from a competition perspective for a long time, and that informed the decisions that we made. It informed how we prioritize and allocate resources. So here's what I do believe. If we don't change the trajectory that we have been on, if we don't have sustained, predictable, adequate levels of funding, if we don't look carefully at those areas where we are now challenged by Russia, China, and frankly others in space, in cyberspace, in the maritime domain, in the land domain, frankly everywhere, if we don't change that trajectory, then whoever's in my job in 2023 and 2024, so not 10 or 15 years down the road, but actually 4 or 5 or 6 years down the road, will probably not have the same degree of confidence in talking about our ability to meet alliance commitments. The good news is that with the support of Congress over the last couple of years, we have changed that trajectory, and that goes back at least to 2017, where we began to prioritize and allocate resources in a different way. We began to realize that we needed to look at tomorrow, even as we dealt with the challenges today. And I think that's where we might have been out of balance for a few years, is that we were spending most of our budget dealing with the fight we had, and probably not being as attentive as we needed to be in terms of developing the capabilities we need tomorrow based on the trends that are taking place in emerging technologies and so forth. So, again, I wouldn't want the NDS to be read as where we are today, I think it's a better, and I have read it, and I think it does clearly articulate what is necessary to maintain that competitive advantage into the future.
So you say you're confident today, but you know, someone in your position in 5 or 6 years' time wouldn't be confident. What does that mean? Does that mean that if we were to go to war with China, we would lose?
No, it doesn't mean we would lose, but it certainly could take much more time than we envisioned, and we could suffer a great deal more casualties than we might have otherwise. And to be specific, without going into a lot of detail, when we talk about competitive advantage, the source of strength for the U.S. military has historically been our ability to project power when and where necessary to advance our national interests, combined with the network of allies and partners that we have built up since World War II. So those two things combined are our competitive advantage. What Russia and China have been on a path of doing is to undermine, number one, the cohesion of our allies and partners. And number two, they have studied us from a military perspective. They studied what we did in 1991, 1990, and Desert Shield, Desert Storm. They studied what we did in 2003. They realized that our source of strength was the ability to move large amounts of men, material, and equipment wherever it needed to be in the world to advance their interests. And what they did was identify what they perceived to be some vulnerabilities, and they have developed systems specifically designed to disrupt our ability to project power. That in itself could be seen as a weakness in an inability to meet alliance commitments, which further contributes to the political space where we're undermining the credibility. So I think from a U.S. military perspective, it's incumbent upon us to continue to develop those capabilities that give our allies and partners the confidence that we can meet the commitments that we have, and also ensure that Russia and China understand that we do have the capability to respond if deterrence fails. That conventional relative capability that we have had over the past couple of decades is actually a fundamental element of peace.
And you know, you've made a point there about disruptive technology that they have invested in. Is the U.S. military failing to modernize?
No, I wouldn't say we're failing, but I also would tell you I'm never complacent about the pace of modernization. I think if you look at where we are today, we do have a technological advantage over Russia and China. But the point I was making earlier is if you look at the investments that they have made over the past decade, they've invested at a greater rate in tomorrow than we have relative to their overall budget. I don't say that as a reflection of the total amount of money that we're investing in. But it is incumbent upon us right now not only to invest in the technologies, but also to invest in the ideas. And to be, you know, specific for the audience, we very carefully analyze what we call competitive areas. And there's about 14 competitive areas. It's, you know, it's a classified assessment. But it's areas that you'd all be familiar with, space, cyberspace, the maritime domain, electromagnetic spectrum, and so forth. And we've analyzed the path of capability development that Russia and China have been on. We've analyzed where they'll be in 2025, and we've identified very specifically the areas where increased investment is required by the United States and its allies and partners. This is not, I can't imagine going to war without our allies and partners, and so they need to be on the same path of capability development we're on. But the point is that we now know the areas where we will be challenged, and in order to ensure we have that competitive advantage I described, we just need to make sure that both, it's not just a question of funding, it's not just a question of technology, it's a combination of ideas and technology.
Let's talk about the budget and funding, because the report says the budget is too small, and that the president has now called for a 5% budget cut on defense spending. This week I spoke to Ambassador Eric Edelman, who was the co-chair of the commission, and he says a cut risks strategic insolvency. Who is right then?
Well, I don't. It's not that simple, Alda. it never is. Look, I think we have many members of the Senate Armed Services Committee and member of the House Armed Services Committee here, and I think for me the issue is those three words. It's got to be sustained. It's got to be predictable. Allows us to make the right decisions, and then it has to be adequate. Our job is to take the resources that we've been given after the dialogue between the executive branch and the legislative branch has taken place, to take the resources that we've been given and make sure that we use them wisely in those areas that will result in the best outcome in a campaign in the future. Last year, both the Secretary and I testified publicly that We thought, based on the analysis that we had done, that about a 3 to 5% growth over time was going to be necessary to restore that competitive advantage that we had. What I think is as important as the top line, because that's what people all focus on, and I think the members of the delegation here would agree, it's not just about the top line. It's about the degree of predictability that will allow us to use the resources we have more wisely. And various levels of resources can be accommodated if there is, in fact, a path of predictability that allows us to make sound investments over a course of 5 or 7 or 10 years.
And I take your point on that, because there are people here who I've spoken to who have said it's not the budget that's the problem, it's how it's being spent and used. And over the last 2 years, you have had a big budget boost, and a lot of that money has been spent, you know, on the kind of platforms that services like, the big ships and manned fighter aircrafts. Is that the kind of U.S. military that you want to see in, say, a decade's time?
Well, first of all, a great amount of money that we spend has also gone into development of our cyber capabilities, resilience of our space capabilities, modernization of our nuclear enterprise, initiatives to deal with the electromagnetic spectrum. So, the public characterization, I think, that we have bought things that we're used to having, airplanes and ships, those are still required. I still think they'll be required, at least for the foreseeable future. But, in fact, the investments we made in 17 and 18 have been in fundamentally different areas. And one of the things that the Secretary has really driven this year is increased investment in research and development to make sure that we're spending an adequate amount of money on tomorrow. And that's one of the areas that we, frankly, assumed risk for a long period of time, was in research and development, science and technology. Those investments that will allow us to maintain an edge technologically in the future. So it's not an either-or. It's getting the right balance, and I think that's what we have sought to do over the past 2 years, and I think when people see the 2020 budget, they will see that the Secretary's guidance has been to get the right balance across all those capability areas so that at the end of the day, in the aggregate, we have what we need.
In the past, great power competition has often led to great power war. How serious a risk is there of war with China and Russia?
Well, I think it's, again, in the military dimension, and those that are here know this, the thing that we do in the military dimension is to make sure that we're doing all we can to have transparency and communications that mitigate the risk miscalculation and help us to manage a crisis. So even as we have built up capabilities, and we make it very clear, these are to assure our allies and deter potential aggression by Russia or China, I think that, we've been very transparent about that, but I've also been very aggressive in maintaining very effective lines of communication with both my Russian counterpart as well as our Chinese counterparts. And Admiral Davison's here today. I know he'll speak in the next session about the engagement that he has across the region. So our argument has been that competition does not necessarily lead to conflict. And provided we have a framework within which to manage the risk of miscalculation and again, manage a crisis should one occur, we'd be in pretty good shape. The other thing we do is, even just simple things day to day to help us avoid that are rules of the road for how our ships operate, how our airplanes operate. And we have mechanisms, both with Russia and China, to make sure that we're doing things in a safe, in effective way, and we're not collapsing decision space for political leaders with military activity that takes place.
Eric Schmidt was here at Halifax last year, and he spoke about the impact of artificial intelligence on the future of warfare. Vladimir Putin famously said that whoever masters AI will rule the world. Do you agree that we're in an AI arms race with Russia and China?
I don't think there's any question that one of the characteristics in the character war today is speed. And I don't think there's any question that AI, I don't think we even begin, and I've done it recently, did a literature search and pulled down, 10 or 15 of the current articles on AI and even having a common definition and a common understanding of the implications of AI, I think would be a debate that would take place over the course of hours. But I'm convinced in terms of supporting decision making and then achieving mass in terms of capability that AI has extraordinary potential. And I do think that whoever masters AI is going to have a decided competitive advantage as a result.
Google very publicly withdrew from the project Maven. Well, what do you make of U.S. tech companies who don't want to necessarily work alongside the Pentagon but are quite happy and willing to work in China?
Look, I think, and again, many of our allies are represented here. I think the tech companies need to look at the values for which we stand and what this is all about. And I really do have a hard time, without highlighting any specific company, I have a hard time with companies that are working very hard to engage in the market inside of China, in engaging in arrangements where intellectual property is shared with the Chinese, which if you share it with the Chinese, it's synonymous with sharing it with the Chinese military, and then don't want to work for the U.S. military. And I just have a simple expression. We are the good guys. The people sitting in this room that stand for democracy, we're the good guys. And they should know that the relationship that the United States military has had, and frankly all the militaries represented here, has had with industry, going back to World War II, our competitive advantage has been the relationship and the industrial base of the United States and the human capital in the United States that we've been able to take advantage of is what has given us a competitive advantage. And quite frankly, we need a reliable, effective partnership with the tech companies inside the United States and, for that matter, in all of our countries that are democracies to ensure that we can protect democracy. And that's what we ought to look at this. This is not about doing something that's unethical, illegal, or immoral. This is about ensuring that we collectively can defend the values for which we stand. And that would be the argument I would make to the tech companies.
Let's talk about Afghanistan. The U.S. increased the number of forces last year to reverse the Taliban momentum. I was there this summer, and the security situation is perhaps worse than ever. I mean, militarily, can you tell us whether the U.S. strategy is still working?
Sure. Just for a minute, I think it's worthwhile to just go back and talk briefly about the path that we've been on. And, the only time Article 5 of NATO was invoked was in the wake of 9/11. And at one time, we had over 50 nations that responded. But those 50 nations from 2001 to 2013 actually provided security in Afghanistan. In 2013, June of 2013, we transitioned and the Afghans assumed responsibility for security. I think it's helpful to remind everybody that at that point, we had almost 140,000 U.S. and NATO forces on the ground. From 2013 to 2017, we went from 140,000 down to about 8,500. I was there during much of that time in 2013 to 2014. And although we had a focus on training the Afghan security forces, we did not have a focus at the right level of the Afghan forces. We did not have sufficient resources, and we didn't leave sufficient enabling capability in the form of aviation support, intelligence support for the Afghans. So if I looked at Afghanistan, I look at it in kind of three pieces. The first piece is we provided security. We then turned it over to the Afghans without adequate support. And really what, in the military dimension, what the South Asia strategy was all about was carefully assessing at what level we needed to advise the Afghans, what were the kind of advisors that we needed to have, and what was the sufficient level of support to allow them to compete with the Taliban. So we did that in 2017, and I think now we have a military plan that resources properly the Afghan forces. We never thought that that would result in instant results, because a key piece of what we're talking about is not only providing coalition allied support, but it's also the training of the Afghan forces, leadership development of the Afghan forces, dealing with corruption and those kinds of things. Here's what I think about in terms of Afghanistan. We're not going to have a solution as a military solution. Success in Afghanistan is an Afghan-owned, Afghan-led reconciliation process. That requires us to have political pressure, social pressure, and military pressure. In the military dimension, our task is to make sure the Taliban realize that they cannot win on the battlefield.
But they're not losing either.
They are not losing right now. I think that's a fair statement. And we used the term stalemate a year ago, and relatively speaking, it hasn't changed much. But without going into any detail here, we do believe that the Taliban know that at some point they have to reconcile. So I think moving forward, what we've got to continue to do is apply increasing pressure militarily. And when I talk about social or religious pressure, I'm talking about the fatwas that came out of Indonesia, fatwas out of Saudi Arabia, fatwas out of Pakistan that create some pressure. The elections that just took place, largely successful and less violent certainly than people predicted. And I think political transition in 2019 will also be critical in putting pressure on the Taliban. But the key to success is to combine all of that pressure to incentivize the Taliban for, again, that Afghan-led reconciliation process. And while there's much going on in that regard below the surface, I think we're a long way from where we can say that we're on the right path.
I mean, politically, the Afghan government is fragile. So, I mean, politically, why would they cut a deal, the Taliban, if they don't feel like they're losing?
Well, I think what was very helpful last year, and I think one of the keys to the South Asia strategy was a conditions-based approach. And I would also say that the decision by NATO and partner nations to support the Afghan National Defense Security Forces through 2024 absolutely affects the Taliban calculus. So I think if you're the Taliban, we used to describe every December as the Y2K effect. In other words, there was always, you spent the whole year talking about the allies are going to leave in December. They're going to leave and we're not going to be there. And one of the key elements of the South Asia strategy is that collectively, not just the United States, but NATO and the partner nations that have contributed to forces, we've all made a commitment that we're going to have a conditions-based approach and we are going to support the Afghan government in that Afghan-owned, Afghan-led reconciliation process. And more importantly, we're going to help set the conditions where that is a viable path.
I'm just going to open it up to the audience now because I know there are many people here who'd like to ask some questions just at the front here.
Thank you, Yalda. And General Dunford, welcome to Halifax. It's wonderful that you're here. Thank you for your presentation. We've talked a lot about extraterritorial missions, as we should and as we often do. I'd like to ask you a little bit about the homeland and the home game. We're seeing dramatic changes in the Arctic. We're seeing the opening of waters. Secretary Chuck Hagel was here a few years ago and talked about an Arctic strategy. I'm just wondering, in your capacity as Chief of Joint Staff, how much of that enters into the discussion, into the defense strategy, about the changes that are happening here around North America, the vulnerability in the maritime domain, and touch, if you would, on missile defense when it comes to the defense of North America, the home
sure,
game.
Sure. No, I mean, you've characterized a couple of the major challenges that occupy, needless to say, a great deal of our time. First of all, in recognition, not just to the Arctic, but a wide range of other challenges, if you want to just take a look at how our practices have changed over the past decade. So years ago, we would plan for specific contingencies. So much of our planning was focused, we call them operational plans, and they were focused on a fairly narrow contingency. When we look at challenges like China, Russia, Iran, North Korea now, we look at it from a global perspective. I mean, that's one thing that has changed. We talk about the character war. We can't imagine any conflict that doesn't have implications across all regions and across all domains, to include the Arctic. So if you were to look at our plans, for example, for Russia a decade ago, and you would look at our plans for Russia today, it's a much more comprehensive global approach, and we do think that the implications in the Arctic have affected our military planning. There's no question about it. With regard to missile defense, again, getting back to the character war, if you just use the Korea scenario, in the 1990s, we had an approach focused on regional conflict. And if a conflict had opened, had occurred in South Korea, it would have been largely a sea, air, land campaign. And for us, militarily, we would have focused all of our support for the commander that was on the ground to deal with what was going on in the peninsula. Today, obviously, every one of those challenges I outlined has implications not just within a particular geographic region, but also has implications for the homeland. You mentioned specifically missile defense, but certainly cyber, space, other areas where we're challenged. What we need to do with missile defense, and we're, I think, just in the process of completing our missile defense review right now, we've been working on that for some time, is to have the right balance of defensive capabilities, both in the homeland and forward, with our allies, partners, and our military capabilities forward, but also then the right balance of offensive capabilities to deal with the enemy threat. And so that's, as we go into our budget for 2020 and beyond, getting the right balance between defensive and offensive capabilities that deal with the enemy's overall strike capability is what we're trying to do.
François Heisberg from the IISS. General, your commander-in-chief has signaled recently that he wanted the United States to withdraw from the INF Treaty due to Russian violations. From a military perspective, Would the American withdrawal from the treaty offer you new opportunities? And how would you exploit these opportunities, either vis-à-vis Russia and or vis-à-vis China, since the president, in one of his official Twitter messages, since these are now the official mode of communication, indicated that this was just about as much about China as it is about Russia. Thank you for your thoughts.
No, thanks. First of all, we've known Russia was in violation of the INF treaty now for a couple of years. And we've all certainly tried to encourage them to come into compliance. We have not withdrawn, so a political decision is not made. I'm not going to speculate as to when that might be or how that might unfold. What I would tell you is that within the treaty, we are allowed to conduct research and development in certain capabilities that would not be treaty compliant, and we're doing that. And we're also looking at treaty compliant ways to deal with the challenges of both Russia and China. But the INF is not about China. The INF is about Russia's failure to comply with the INF. And so I think the primary focus has been to move Russia back in compliance with the INF. And then we'll deal with emerging technologies and other challenges in other ways. And that's exactly what we're doing.
We just got a question just at the front.
Thank you. Mara Carlin, Johns Hopkins Sykes. Yeah. We've spent a lot of today talking about the future of conflict with China and Russia. But as we know, the U.S. military has never been at war for so long with such inconclusive results. I'd be curious to hear your thinking on what the legacy is of these last 17 years.
Sure. Thanks, Mara. I've read much of what you've written. We haven't had ever a chance to meet. another person that keeps us honest from time to time. Look, let me talk about violent extremism and kind of how we think about that strategically. So the underlying conditions that have fed extremism, and we've been dealing with the manifestations of extremism, terrorism, mass migration, that creates great political and economic instability for some time. And some people describe it now as a generational conflict, and I wouldn't disagree with that characterization. We're going to be dealing with this for a long period of time to come. So when I look at violent extremism, I think there's three things that we have to think about at the strategic level: the flow of foreign fighters, resources, and the ideology. And we need a strategic approach that actually, and if you think of those as connective tissue, we need a strategic approach that cuts the connective tissue between groups in West Africa, East Africa, the Middle East, and Southeast Asia. And then we need to grow the capacity of local forces to deal with that challenge. But at the end of the day, what I'll be recommending to our political leadership, both in the executive branch and the legislative branches, if you think about our strategy, the national defense strategy, we come back to the opening question. What we really need to do with regard to violent extremism is have a sustainable solution to that in the context of the other challenges that we face. And when I say sustainable, it's got to be politically sustainable, it's got to be fiscally sustainable, it's got to be militarily sustainable in the context of the national defense strategy and the greater challenges. So I think the legacy of the last few years is one we will see in the coming years, which is we are dealing with terrorism, we are dealing with migration issues that create that instability, and what the art is, and this is where we're trying to be balanced today, is the art is to have sufficient forces engaged and sufficient political engagement, sufficient economic resources to make sure that we're putting pressure and disrupting those networks so we mitigate the risk to our people from these terrorist acts. We try to keep people home and safe, in their own countries, even as we recognize that dealing with the underlying conditions that feed extremism are going to be with us a long period of time. So from the military dimension, what I would tell you is that we do need a long-term plan for counterterrorism. We need a long-term plan to build the capacity of our partners to provide their own security. And the legacy is one that this is a different kind of war than a state versus state conflict that has a clean ending. And it is not at the end of the day a military war. This is a broader issue with a military dimension. And the military dimension, again, is conducting counterterrorism and building the capacity of our partners.
In the back there, maybe in the back.
Hello, I'm Igor Janka from Poland. General, I'm interested in your thoughts about the American presence in the eastern flank of NATO, especially in Poland, where we are about strengthening the American presence, where we are now and where we will go.
Sure. The question concerns Poland, and some of you may know that the President of Poland recently engaged with President Trump and offered $2 billion to have U.S. forces in Poland. And I think what we all – no decision has been made as to exactly the nature of those forces. What we have said to our Polish interlocutors is you can be guaranteed of an American flag in Poland. That'll be there. You can be guaranteed of military capability being there and our ability to meet our commitment to Poland's security. But what we're now talking about is what is the most effective organizational construct for that presence. And there's several ways that can be accomplished. It can be accomplished with permanent forces forward, but it can also be accomplished with highly ready rotational forces that demonstrate our commitment to Poland and even at the same time deter any potential adversary.
Bonnet Rivers, I'm just at the back.
Thank you, Gilda. Barnett Rubin, Center on International Cooperation, New York University. Hello, General, and hello, Admiral Davidson. Good to see you again.
Good to see you too, Barney. Right.
Thank you. You spoke about how the U.S. has been falling behind a bit at its relative military edge and how you're trying to redress that through spending. But the fundamental reason that is happening is not because of budgetary decisions by the U.S. Congress. It's because of the economic development of the world. The U.S. is not economically in the place that it was in, relative to other countries, in the place it was in 1945, or even in the place it was in 2000. Isn't there a danger that if we try to maintain the same military edge that we had when we had a much greater economic edge, that our expenditures will become unbalanced and we will actually damage ourselves economically and in the long run have problems, I won't say on this scale, but similar to those that the Soviet Union encountered toward the end of its days and that Pakistan encounters?
Barney, let me quote Secretary Mattis and start by saying we can afford survival. Democracy can support survival. We can collectively support survival. We can afford survival. And I'm not sure I agree with you that it's just economics, because at 3 to 4% of our gross domestic product, both past and what's projected to be future, I think we can provide for defense. And I also think it's important to know that we're not going to be doing this by ourselves. And in investments that all democracies are making in their military capability is going to give us an aggregate ability to do what has to be done. I guess I reject that we're in a position where economically we can't be competitive. I believe our economy can support us being competitive, and I think at that historic level of investment, which, by the way, is lower than at many points in our history, at that level of investment, we can deliver the right capabilities. And it isn't just a question of, as you pointed out, it isn't just a question of money. It's a question of money, technology, ideas. And doing things sometimes in fundamentally different and disruptive ways is the path we need to be on. And as we're fond of quoting inside the Pentagon, whether it was Winston Churchill or a 19th century physicist who gets credit for this, you know, the ladies and gentlemen, we're out of money, it's time to think, actually applies to the U.S. military as well. And we cannot buy our way out of many of the challenges that we have. We have to think our way out of these challenges. Money is but a component of that. Materials are but a component of that. But non-material solutions to some of the challenges that we face right now, and I'm not making light of it, but operational concepts and so forth are very important. If you ask me today what my priorities are as the chairman moving forward, over the next 2 years, it's our exercise program, our experimentation program, and the priorities we have for innovation are probably going to consume the majority of my time. Over the last couple of years, we've built a strategic framework for dealing with these challenges. We've taken that strategic framework and put an assessment process so we have a very clear-eyed understanding of where we are and where we need to go. And now a combination of the investments that we make as well as our experimentation and exercises is going to allow us to maintain a competitive edge. And again, there's many countries here represented that I suspect will be with us in any future endeavor.
Gentleman at the back.
Joseph Joffe, my question actually follows right up upon the previous one. Can you give us a 3-minute seminar in defense spending? And here's my question. The Chinese and the Russians spend about high double-digit billions on defense. The U.S. spends high triple-digit billions on defense. So what's the problem with keeping up?
Yeah, I can do that in less than 3 minutes. First of all, we have global responsibilities as the United States, and we have been the leader of the free world for the last seven decades. And we have alliance commitments in the Pacific, five specifically. We have alliance commitments in Europe, and we have partnerships and security relationships elsewhere in the world and responsibilities elsewhere in the world. And we have, with our allies and partners, been a guarantor of the international order that will be discussed a great deal today and was last night. And those responsibilities associated with being the leader of the free world, the responsibilities associated with meeting those alliance commitments I just spoke about, make a comparison between what Russia and China spend on defense a complete apples and oranges conversation.
I'll come to you next.
Hello, Mauricio Mejulán from Mexico. My question would be then this. Would you say that the U.S. were too late in recognizing that you were focusing too much in local conflicts or in terrorist strategies vis-a-vis what you needed to be doing during this past decade or so?
Sitting where I sit in 2018, would I wish that we had changed the trajectory before we did? Yes. We had some very significant fiscal challenges. If you go back to 2013 and sequestration and the unpredictability of the budget, we probably made some decisions that I certainly would have made different decisions had I known what the next 7 or 8 years would look like. I would have made different decisions. But, you know, to use a golf metaphor, I suppose, you got to play the ball where it lies. We are where we are. We know where we need to go. And so we need to be looking forward, not backwards. Again, to answer your question specifically, would I have wished that we made certain investments 5 or 7 years ago and actually been able to field certain capabilities today? Yes. But I quickly add, we do have a competitive advantage today. We can meet our alliance commitments now. The question is, can we run fast enough to maintain that competitive advantage in the future? I would argue we can. We can do that. And the trajectory we're on is the right trajectory. We just have to be able to sustain it.
So is that gentleman just,
Good morning, General. Kevin Barron, Executive Editor of Defense One. I have a question about the border deployment. Right before this session started, I watched you lead the applause for the recipients of the award, which was basically for welcoming migrants and refugees to the Greek island of Lesbos. It stands in stark contrast to the U.S. military deployment at the border, so especially for people in this room who look at that as the complete opposite effect. Explain to us your thinking, why you support that, or if you didn't, whatever your advice was. Again, in your heart and mind, why you think that's a moral order, why you carried it out, what's your thinking behind that?
Yeah, first of all, Kevin, I reject the characterization or the comparison between the admirable work that we just recognized a minute ago in our U.S. military force on the border. And I would tell you with a great deal of pride that when our young men and women go, they bring the values of the American people with them. And our record in that regard, I think, stands on its own. In the border, I want to make it clear what we're doing. Number one, we're providing engineering support to reinforce the points of entry. Number two, we're providing logistical and medical support to Customs and Border Police, who actually have the responsibility to be at the border and process people properly. And we're using rotary wing support to help move them around. So the tasks that we are providing are in support of the Department of Homeland Security. And nothing that we are doing is illegal. And I can tell you we looked at that very carefully. And what we are doing right now in support of Customs and Border Police and Homeland Security more broadly is filling legitimate capability gaps that they have with military capabilities. We are not coming in contract with the migrants. Our job is not to deny access of migrants into the United States. Our job is to support the Department of Homeland Security in doing their job. I think it's important you understand that.
Can I ask a question about divisions in the U.S.? Virtually every public institution is politicized, whether that's Congress or the Supreme Court, Wall Street, my industry, the media. But the military has stood apart. It feels like the one thing that most Americans can agree on. It's broadly trusted, broadly respected. Are you worried that that'll change?
I am not, and I would first of all, I won't comment on any other institutions, but we do have a very strong nonpartisan, apolitical ethos in the U.S. military, and I view one of my more important responsibilities as the chairman as being the steward of that ethos, and I'm very proud of our men and women over the past couple of years during a very contentious political period in our history, that the institution has remained apolitical and nonpartisan. And I think that we have members from both sides of the aisle here, and I think they would back that up. We don't participate in politics. And I'm very careful when we get questions like Kevin asks to stay in our lane and address the military dimension of the problem and not come in publicly on policy. I don't think in our nation we want generals to be deciding where we use force. We want generals to be deciding how to best accomplish the political objectives that have been outlined by our properly elected officials. And so as long as we use that as our, you know, true north, if you will, we'll be where we have always been in the United States. We will be a trusted institution. We swear to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States. No political party, no individual, the Constitution of the United States. And every time we promote somebody, every time we reenlist somebody, we in public have them to repeat that oath in the gathering of people there to witness the event. And we do that to remind ourselves of our first and most important responsibility, which is to the Constitution of the United States, and that is our azimuth.
Thank you, General. Karen DeYoung, I'm with the Washington Post. I wanted to ask you a question about the Middle East and specifically about Saudi Arabia, which has been identified by the administration as a key ally for our military in the region. It's no secret that that relationship's under a lot of strain right now, and there are a number of bills, including sponsored by members of the Senate that are here today, to stop all U.S. military assistance and sales to Saudi Arabia. I wondered if you, from a military perspective and a national security perspective, could talk about what difference that would make for U.S. capabilities and U.S. goals in the region, and whether the current problems with Saudi Arabia, most of which revolve around human rights issues, and speaking from the ceremony this morning, whether that association, as Saudi Arabia is accused of human rights abuses, has its own downside beyond the military relationship that could affect our objectives in the region.
Karen, it's a great question, but with reference to the previous question, I'm not going to address the policy with Saudi Arabia right now, but I will answer the question from the military dimension. Saudi Arabia has been an important partner to regional security in the past. I expect they will be in the future. I think one of the things that we focus on in the Middle East is the capacity of our partners in the Middle East, whether that be Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, Bahrain, and so forth. And their cooperation, their interoperability, in my judgment, is a good thing. Their cooperation, interoperability, capability, if you will, would be a stabilizing force in the region, has been a stabilizing force in the region. And working forward, we will listen carefully to whatever the policy is in the wake of recent events and look towards the long term to ensure that with our partners in the region, one of which is Saudi Arabia, a key partner in the region, we develop an effective military-to-military relationship moving forward to achieve our common objectives.
We've got time for a couple more questions, so I'll just take the lady in the back and then.
Thank you. Hi, General Dunford. Courtney Kuby with NBC News. I want to press you on one thing you said about Afghanistan earlier, that the Taliban, you feel confident the Taliban know they need to reconcile. Why do you feel so confident about that? You know, they've waited out other strategies in the past, whether they've been conditions-based or a timeline-based. Why is there some evidence that the U.S. has that the Taliban is now willing to come to the table? And then second, we haven't really talked about Syria at all today. The administration has made it pretty clear that one of the goals in Syria now is to remove Iran and its proxies. Do you see a U.S. military role in that goal in the future? And how long do you see that meaning, or how long would the U.S. military presence in Syria
be necessary if that's now one of the administration's goals.
Sure. Courtney, first of all, to be very clear, when I talked about Afghanistan, I thought I said that the Taliban were convinced they couldn't win militarily, and that the pressure militarily combined with social and political pressure would lead them to reconciliation. So I did not say that what we're doing in the military dimension was directly going to correlate to reconciliation. I said it would contribute. So there's a military dimension of the problem, but in and of itself, that won't be sufficient. So I hope that clarification addresses that. With regard to Syria, I think I'd be equally clear in that our mission in Syria is to defeat ISIS. We are now supporting our partners on the ground, the Syrian Democratic Forces, in clearing the last remnants of ISIS. Much work remains to be done because when we talk about defeat, we not only talk about clearing those areas that are currently held by ISIS, but we also talk about stabilizing those areas that have been cleared. And stabilization includes training local security forces to prevent ISIS from coming back and then restoring basic services, power, light, trash removal, and those kind of things for stabilization. So our military presence is really related to two things. One is it's completing the defeat of ISIS and the transition after stabilization to local security and local governance. The second piece is that our presence in Syria is designed to support Secretary Pompeo in his political efforts in the Geneva process. We do not have a military mission in Syria that is associated with Iran. We do have a broad objective of Iran leaving Syria, and that is being pursued in the political space right now and perhaps the economic space. But our presence in Syria is directly in support of the defeat ISIS mission.
And I believe there was a question.
General, I'm Ingrid Erda from the Norwegian Defense, an advisor to our Chad. I really appreciate your statement on that larger budgets is not always the solution to our future challenges. And I really recognize this from my own country. But could you please share some thoughts about how we develop the culture, the creative and smart culture, in order to make this happen?
Sure, and you're talking about capability development.
Yes, capability development and the way you solve your security issues.
Sure. I can, and it's something, as I alluded to a minute ago, I've spent a great deal of time on. In fact, the day that I left to come to Halifax, Thursday, I spent 4 hours over at our National Defense University with all of our instructors, all of our staff, and then we've got a group of about 60 or 70 flag officers, general officers, and mentors. And we spent the whole time speaking about innovation, global integration, and frankly, the path of the exercises, the experimentation that I spoke about earlier. And, you know, one of the things that somebody asked me last night about budgets is there's a great disincentive to fail, right? There's a great disincentive to fail. And by definition, experimentation means you're testing a hypothesis and it may or may not prove to be true, and then at some point you've got to change the path that you're on. And what we are trying to do is, while being good stewards of resources and mitigating the risk of spending resources in places where it doesn't result in capability, that we also take sufficient risk to see what is in the art of the possible in the future. Part of that is in our education process, and that's where I'm going with this, is that our professional military education has to focus on critical thinking, has to focus on identifying the critical elements of complex problems as we move forward. And so we're transitioning our professional military education to a historic case study basis. We've been doing that in certain locations. Some schools have been ahead of others in terms of going to a historic case model basis in our professional military education. But that's the path that we're on right now. And the reason is that historical case study will ensure that we're informed by history, not necessarily a slave or driven by history, but we're informed by history. But at the same time, what it will do is expose us to the critical thinking skills and problem-solving ability that you need to deal with the problems that are increasingly complex. So in my judgment, it's the emphasis. We look at education, we look at training, right? Training is how to do something. Education is how to think. And the emphasis now in our education system is making sure that we are doing all we can to teach future leaders how to think in the complex security environment of the 21st century.
Ladies and gentlemen, that brings our session to an end. Please thank General Dunford.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Great.
The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The things, you know, again, I love listening to that stuff. I don't know if everybody does, but I do. And because, you know, you cannot digest our policies around the world by simply watching the news, because that hour, out of that whole hour of him articulating budgets, what we're doing in Poland, what we're doing vis-a-vis China and Russia, vis-a-vis economically, can we sustain this given the rising expenditures of China specifically? All of that was reduced to his comments about Google and artificial intelligence and we're the good guys. That was the story that came out of that hour. And so, to me, it misses the boat. During that hour, there was reference made to a report that was published last week. The report's entitled Providing for the Common Defense, the Assessments and Recommendations of the National Defense Strategy Commission. When this thing hits the website, if you're listening to it on a podcast, you can go to this post and you'll see the link that will take you to a downloadable PDF version of that. Yeah, how about that? All right, we'll take a quick break. Michael Musselman will join us next on a Monday before Thanksgiving. Don't touch that dial. More of Almarine Radio coming up next.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
Hi, this is Tim McGarry from the McGarry Mortgage Minute, heard every Wednesday right here on Almarine Radio, where I'll answer all your mortgage questions from home buying to home financing, from VA to conventional loans to moving in. So don't miss it, the McGarry Mortgage Minute, right here on Almarine Radio, on the All Warrior Radio Network. And remember, my name is McGarry, and I'm here to help.
Find all of Tim McGarry's contact information on the Read Board page at AllMarineRadio.com.
To be fully fit, you have to be physically fit. You also have to be mentally fit.
I wish that more warriors would realize how important it is that you get the psychological support that you need so that you can focus on the rest of your life.
I think it takes strength in order to admit that you have an issue. But it also takes intuitiveness of a friend, a leader, a supervisor to pick up on the signal that the soldier is having issues and needs to seek professional help in dealing with it.
It's also important for the lowest possible levels of leadership to be very supportive in helping their members get the help that they need.
When I went to get help, I had more help than I could ask for from my entire command.
It's sometimes challenging to come to a senior staff member or senior officer in the unit with a problem. There's not a commanding officer out there or a leadership staff out there that doesn't want to help. So don't hesitate. Come ask.
Learn more by visiting www.realwarriors.net or calling 1-866-966-1020.